It's the NPR News Update for Friday, October 24th. I'm Phil Picardi. Stand by for news on the podcast. Today, Hillary Clinton visits Minnesota. The GOP pulls a photo from a campaign ad. A Twin Cities woman can't move on after her husband's Ebola death. Minnesota has more to offer in the Apple Wars. The weekend brings a celebration of poetry at the U of M. And a Minnesotan plays Lead Belly. First, two potential 2016 presidential rivals were in Minnesota yesterday, but not to campaign for themselves. Instead, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vice President Joe Biden were trying to drum up support for Democrats running in the midterm election. The visits were the latest in a virtual parade of big-name Democrats this month. Republican candidates in Minnesota haven't seen a similar show of support from luminaries in their party, but they contend they can win without it. Tom Scheck reports.
Hillary Clinton headlined a get-out-the-vote rally for Senator Al Franken and Governor Mark Dayton on the campus of McAllister College in St. Paul. Standing before a crowd of mostly college students, Clinton urged them to think about their future.
The question really is, are you going to tune out or turn out?
Clinton, a former senator from New York and First Lady, told the nearly 2,000 supporters that Dayton and Franken have accomplished many things during their respective first terms. Clinton said Franken worked to increase oversight of the banking sector and helped pass the Farm Bill. And she praised Minnesota's governor, saying Dayton balanced the budget, increased the minimum wage, and spent more money for schools.
You know, the states are the great laboratories of democracy. And we should be learning from each other about what works and what doesn't work. Minnesota is at the top of the list in showing what works.
Clinton was the latest national Democrat to campaign in the state. First Lady Michelle Obama, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, and former President Bill Clinton have all been here this month. Democrats are hoping the events energize voters in what is typically a down year for Democratic turnout. Franken and Dayton were both elected to office after recounts. Franken reminded the audience that he won by just 312 votes and that he needed every supporter to show up again at the polls this year.
And that's why we are going to be pestering the living daylights out of you. Out of each and every one of you, we are going to be relentless. We're going to be in your face.
The second event on Hillary Clinton's Minnesota agenda was more exclusive than the first. She held a private fundraiser for Dayton after the rally. Franken's opponent, Republican Mike McFadden, said Clinton's event and Michelle Obama's visit earlier this week shows just how close Franken is to the Obama administration.
Having the First Lady and Hillary Clinton in town is just a reminder of all the problems that have been produced by this current administration.
McFadden will be campaigning on Saturday in Rochester with Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. While Clinton was in St. Paul, Vice President Joe Biden was in northeastern Minnesota, trying to nail down support for DFL Congressman Rick Nolan in an area that typically has been a reliable Democratic stronghold. Biden held a campaign rally at Hibbing Community College on the Iron Range.
We have a rule back in my state. You keep someone standing more than 15 minutes on a hard floor, you lose their votes.
Biden told roughly 600 people at the rally that Nolan reaches across party lines. Despite attacking Republicans at length, Biden hardly mentioned Nolan's GOP opponent, Stuart Mills.
We need to stand up and holler for what we are for and make no apologies for what we are for. We don't have to make anything up this time, guys. All we got to do is say this is what we're for, and that's what they're for, and let the people choose. Get out the vote. We cannot afford to lose this race.
Mills downplayed the importance of Biden's visit. He says it just shows that Rick Nolan needs help.
That shows the weakness of his campaign, the fact that he has to have all these outside people come in to prop him up. Our message and our candidacy stands on its own. It's strong. The message is great. People are responding to it, and we're going to win on November 4th.
The Nolan Mills race is one of the top five in the country in spending by outside groups. The money has paid for a barrage of negative TV ads on both sides. Redistricting and changing demographics have made the 8th Congressional District more competitive in recent years. The seat has switched from Democratic to Republican and back again over the last two elections. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Republican Party of Minnesota yesterday changed a TV campaign ad critical of DFL Governor Mark Dayton after a Starbucks woman complained about the use of her dead grandson's picture. Yvonne Dean said it was painful to see her family's tragedy used for politics. Here's Tim Pugmire.
The ad showed a photo of Eric Dean, the 4-year-old boy who was killed by his stepmother in 2013. The case triggered a statewide review of child protection services and renewed questions about a state law preventing investigators from looking at previous incidents of abuse.
And downright horrifying that he signed a law making it more difficult to investigate maltreatment cases.
Yvonne Dean was horrified to see an image of her late grandson in the political ad. Dean said it was hurtful and it was wrong.
We are, as a family, are trying to heal, and we can't when these things happen, and it dishonors Eric's memory when it's used this way.
Dean, who describes herself as a Republican voter, said she shared her concerns with state GOP Chairman Keith Downey and asked him to remove the ad. She said Downey initially declined, telling her that the photo was in the public domain. She said Downey also told her that he believes Governor Dayton's policies were to blame for Eric's death. Dean said she's never blamed Dayton or the law he signed.
It wasn't passed until 2014, and that couldn't have done anything with Eric's case. Eric passed in 2013. That couldn't have affected him.
Dean said Downey called her back later and said he would change the ad by removing Eric's picture and story.
I am satisfied that he agreed to work with me and agreed to do that. I am not sure that they were fully aware of the impact that it would have had. I think they should have looked before they leaped.
Through a spokeswoman, Downey declined an interview request. He issued a written statement instead. In it, Downey said he apologized to Dean for not contacting her before the ad was produced. He said a revised version of the ad will begin airing soon. Downey did not back away from his criticism of Dayton. The law referred to in the ad was passed with Democratic and Republican votes last session. Republican gubernatorial candidate Jeff Johnson issued a statement, too, saying he supports the party's decision. This little boy's picture should never have been used in an ad, Johnson said. Dayton campaign spokesman Lyndon Zakula said the governor thinks the ad is disgusting. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
The widow of one of the first Americans to die of Ebola says she and her kids in a Twin Cities suburb are stuck in legal limbo because of fear and anger over the disease. But U.S. officials are pushing hard to make things right. Tim Nelson has more.
Patrick Sawyer came to the U.S. almost 20 years ago from his native Liberia. He got a master's degree at St. Mary's University. He got a job as a group home manager. He married and had children. But his wife, DeConte Sawyer, said his heart was in Africa.
He felt so passionately about Liberia and really wanted to be a part of rebuilding the country. We had had a 14-year civil war, and everything was destroyed.
Sawyer went back to Monrovia in 2008 and had been traveling back and forth between Minnesota and his homeland for years. DeConte Sawyer said he went to work for the steel giant ArcelorMittal and even led a finance ministry delegation to a conference in Nigeria in July. But he got sick at the airport in Lagos and later died. Nigerian press reports say he infected a dozen Nigerians with Ebola. Now the tragedy is compounding. The Nigerian government isn't officially acknowledging his death, and that's a problem for his family now living in Coon Rapids.
I went to the Social Security office, and I filled up the forms. I met with someone there. She took her time, worked with me.
DeConte Sawyer said Social Security found her husband's records, showed her what benefits her daughters would be eligible for, and got her paperwork in order. The girls are 6, 5, and a year old. But Social Security told her there was a catch.
You know, Mrs. Sawyer, we really are going to need the death certificate to move forward.
She said she asked the hospital in Lagos for one, She contacted the Liberian finance minister, who she said had become a friend of her husband, but she got nothing back. Not her husband's cremated remains, not a death certificate, not his health records. Sawyer says she thinks Nigerian officials blame her husband for the outbreak in their country and the deaths that followed. Press reports from a conference in August said Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan called Sawyer a crazy man for traveling to Nigeria and bringing Ebola with him.
They were angry at Patrick. And so that anger is still there, even though he's dead. And because of that anger, I believe they're not releasing his death certificate.
A Social Security spokeswoman in Chicago says the agency can't discuss details of specific cases. But officials here in Minnesota say they're hopeful that they can move the process forward, even from thousands of miles away. Mark Kimball is a spokesman for U.S. Senator Al Franken.
Senator Franken has had his staff working with the State Department to get Mr. Sawyer's remains and his death certificate out of Nigeria as quickly as possible.
Kimball says they are hoping there may soon be some movement in Nigeria.
We are encouraged that today the U.S. consulate in Nigeria sent the Nigerian Ministry of Health a diplomatic note asking them to give this case the highest priority. So we hope that that will bolster the efforts to get this out and get this done as soon as possible.
In the meantime, DeConte Sawyer says she's trying to keep her family together. She works part-time at the Central Minnesota Sexual Assault Center in St. Cloud and says she's struggling financially since her husband died in July. She says it's hard to work more with three small girls to care for alone. And so she's hoping that her husband's legacy won't only be the dread of the disease that killed him and some of the very people that tried to save him in Nigeria.
My heart goes out to those families, as well as all the families that have lost their loved ones to Ebola. I'm one of those people.
Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A new apple variety developed at the University of Minnesota is promising the deliciousness of the Honeycrisp earlier in the season. The apple is called the MN55 for now, and researchers and growers say it's sweet and crisp like the U's flagship apple, but it ripens earlier. That means it has the potential to take over the early season market. Jim Luby is a professor at the U and one of the developers of the apples. He talked with Kathy Werzer.
Okay, MN55, not the sexiest name, of course. What does this taste like?
It's a nice, crisp, juicy, it's sweet, a little bit tart, probably a little bit tartar than Honeycrisp, but along that line, and definitely along the line of Honeycrisp for texture, for the crispness and juiciness.
So why is it important that this ripens earlier in the season?
Currently, the apples that we have early in the season tend to be a little considerably softer than Honeycrisp, and so this will be the first thing that we've had in that part of the season, and I'm talking here in Minnesota, in sort of late August, that really captures, you know, that kind of texture that Honeycrisp has.
Say, when you start developing apples and apple varieties, how tough is that when you start looking at genetics and you're trying to come up with something? I mean, try to talk a little here about the balance that you have to go through.
Well, yeah, you know, every time we make a cross between two parent varieties, we're always thinking, oh, you know, we have a certain thing in mind that we want to get. And it doesn't always work out that way. It's just like if you're a parent and you have kids and you kind of wonder sometimes, where did that kid come from? But this one actually worked out. In this case, this is back in the mid-90s, and we'd already put out Honeycrisp. And we're thinking, you know, it'd be really nice to get that sort of Honeycrisp delight factor earlier in the season, and where we're really lacking some good apples. And so we crossed the Honeycrisp with a very early University of Arkansas variety, and thinking, oh, we'll get the Honeycrisp texture and the earliness from the Arkansas selection. And you know, it actually worked out this time. So sometimes it's nice when genetics works.
But of course, if you're going to use the child metaphor, which you were kind of going for there earlier, you know, everyone's got a different personality. And you know, there are some bumps and challenges that everybody has. What does this apple variety have in terms of any challenge?
probably the biggest challenge is the apples fall off the tree, or can fall off the tree prematurely right before harvest. And so there's various things growers can do to deal with that, but they're definitely going to have to do that. It's not just one of those that you can let go. It's a child that will need some attention.
When will consumers be able to buy this new apple in stores?
Nurseries are just making the very first trees right now for growers to eventually plant in a year or two. So we're really not looking at the first fruit until about 2018 or 2019.
It's named the MN55. Now, I'm presuming there's going to be some kind of a
naming contest. Yeah, it'll have another name. Naming apples is even harder than naming children. You can have two or three Kathys in the classroom, and it's not a big deal. But you can only have one kind of apple, and so every apple has to have a unique name. So in the next 6 to 18 months here, we hope to have a name. We'll be going through with some focus groups, throwing some name candidates out in front of some groups of consumers and growers, and hopefully we'll come up with something interesting that we can talk about here in a few months and that people will see eventually coming to supermarket shelves
and
to their orchards.
Good. And the U of M will hold a patent on this?
Yes, the U of M has filed for a patent on this, correct.
All right. Well, we appreciate your time here this morning. Interesting stuff. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Jim Luby and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. John Berryman would have been 100 tomorrow. He is considered by many to have been one of the great American poets of the 20th century. And this weekend, people from around the world will gather at the University of Minnesota, where Berryman taught, to celebrate his life and work. UNCARE reports Berryman is gaining a broader appreciation from a whole new generation of fans.
With his long beard and black-rimmed glasses, John Berryman was a well-known figure on campus in the 1960s. But he'd led a troubled life. His father committed suicide in front of him when he was a boy. He wrestled with a drinking problem in later years and ended it all by jumping off the Washington Avenue Bridge in 1972. But he left behind a huge body of work, including hundreds of what he called dream songs.
What's so surprising to me and heartening is how healthy I actually think his work is.
Peter Campion teaches creative writing at the University of Minnesota. He is co-organizer of the conference titled John Berryman at 100. He says Berryman created tremendous beauty out of the dark places in his life.
And I think it was tremendously heroic that he was able to hold this pain, even while trying, of course, to cure it, but to channel it into aesthetic artifact, into art.
Berryman brought a myriad of ideas and arguments into his lectures and poems. Here he is reading Dream Song 14.
Life, friends, is boring. We must not say so. After all, the sky flashes, the great sea yearns, we ourselves flash and yearn, and moreover, my mother told me as a boy, repeatedly, ever to confess you're bored means you have no inner resources.
That scene is from a BBC interview in 1967. Berryman glares at the camera and twitches, but it's impossible to stop watching. Poet Jim Moore took classes from him in the mid-60s and says his lectures were much the same.
Berryman was certainly the best teacher I ever had. He was also the most eccentric and in a certain way unreliable.
Moore tells a story about coming in for class one day and finding Berryman asleep at the front of the room. He says none of the 30 or so students had the guts to rouse him, so they all quietly trooped out. However, Moore says he never met anyone as passionate as Berryman about poetry.
He was demanding in the sense that, when he was there and you were there and he was awake, you would be awake because it moved very quickly, those classes, and the associations were pretty amazing. So they demanded a lot of attention.
For many years, Berryman's way of reflecting his own life in his work led to his categorization as a confessional poet. However, Philip Coleman, who teaches at Trinity College Dublin, says that's changing.
I think that for many years, Berryman's reputation and Berryman's profile were locked into a particular way of reading him.
Coleman says he's been amazed to learn how many contemporary poets now see Berryman as an influence for his use of language or his constant self-reinvention. At the U of M, Peter Campion expects hundreds of people at the conference. He says Berryman could mix references from the Bible and Shakespeare with jazz and blues, blending it with language that could be scholarly one moment, then earthy and streetwise the next.
If you came up, as I did, as a kid listening to mixtapes and going to concerts, and it's a very natural jump to John Berryman.
Several of Berryman's books and collections are being reissued to mark the centennial of his birth. Peter Campion hopes readers will seize the opportunity to honor a great American poet.
This is art that's made out of American speech in all of its variety. No matter where you're from, no matter what your background is, if you read and speak American speech, this great art is your birthright.
And that means John Berryman's dream songs live on. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
There's a new 3-CD compilation that comes out next week celebrating the music of Dave Ray. Ray, who died of cancer in 2002, was best known for being part of the blues trio Kerner, Ray, and Glover. But that was just the beginning of a long career in which Ray created an impressive body of music. The box set on Red House Records traces his evolution from an imitator to an interpreter of the blues. The songs were chosen by Tony Glover, who played harmonica with Ray off and on for 40 years. Morning Edition producer Jim Bickle reports.
Any exploration of the music of Dave Ray begins with Lead Belly.
Out in Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama's a good place to go. And you didn't get a break up this old
gym. When Ray was in high school in Minneapolis, he heard this recording of Lead Belly's performance at the University of Minnesota. In an interview recorded in 1996, Ray described how Lead Belly's music affected him.
It was the immediacy of it, the power of it. I was just captivated by it. I mean, it just knocked my socks off. It's like anything else, you know. It's like reading some great poet the first time you read it. It just kills you. You want to do it, you know, especially when you're a teenager.
As a teenager, he spent all his spare time learning Lead Belly songs and playing them at a joint called the Coffee Break in Dinkytown. This song was recorded there in 1964. This recording of Frankie and Albert was one of several Lead Belly tunes that Tony Glover decided to include in the box set. Glover says the selections would have been different if Ray were still alive today.
There are several tunes on the box set that are real faithful Lead Belly reproductions. If he was alive, he wouldn't want them on there. He was embarrassed by the kind of the minstrel show aspect of it. I mean, that's true to an extent, but it's also amazing that, you know, a white blonde kid who doesn't look old enough to do much of anything is able to get the sound of a southern black guy.
They want to know who I was, babe. I turned back and told them one time. Anybody should ask you, told you something. Maybe she didn't snag a baby back here. Hey.
Lead Belly was just the beginning. As a student at the University of Minnesota, Dave Ray teamed up with Tony Glover and John Kerner. They all liked listening to obscure blues records in hopes of finding a hidden gem they could learn to play.
At the time, that kind of music was sort of mystery music. It wasn't really widely available. You had to really look to find copies of the records anywhere. It was kind of like archaeology in a way. We were discovering a music that had been pretty much ignored. The black people had moved beyond it. It was like a dated old slave time music to them. They didn't want anything to do with it. And the white people were listening to white stuff.
Many musicians, including members of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, cite Kerner, Ray, and Glover's 1963 album Blues, Rags, and Hollers as an important influence. Dave Ray continued performing with Kerner and Glover and others. He also released several solo albums and produced records for other artists, including Bonnie Raitt. Unlike most of his contemporaries, Ray never felt compelled to write many original songs. He preferred to keep finding and interpreting old ones.
The other genius thing that Dave had was the ability to pick out and readapt a tune like Uncertain Blues, which was a Jazz Gillum tune. Jazz Gillum was a so-so harp player, but he could write good songs every once in a while.
Well, I started writing letters. No, I believe I'll go back home.
And Dave managed to completely change the tune around, and he's got this whole ascending riff thing that goes up the scale between the verses and kind of puts an edge on it that makes it really cook.
I start to write a letter. No, I believe I'll go back home. And I start to write me a letter, but I believe I'll go back home. I don't talk that well in person. She might not understand the words I wrote.
Dave Ray never made a lot of money playing music. He said he didn't pay much attention to the business side of things. He just liked to play the songs. In April of 2002, he was diagnosed with lung cancer. Tony Glover says Ray decided against chemotherapy. His preferred therapy was to play as much, as often, and in as many places as possible. On November 2, 2002, less than a month before his death, Ray performed at the Cedar Cultural Center in Minneapolis.
It was pretty impressive because Dave was having more and more physical problems at that point. He had stage 4 cancer, and the tumors were growing in his brain and pressing on nerves and affecting his ability to manipulate his hands and so forth. But he kept on pushing, and people talk about it as being a pretty profound experience.
Run over here, little girl. Let daddy talk. I can't believe it all in the way. Put on that wall over here. I believe I changed my mind. She said, I'm so glad I'm living, daddy. I cry, mama, I'm so glad you mind.
That is So Glad I'm Living, an old Arthur Crudup number. It's one of 55 songs performed by Dave Ray on the new Red House compilation, Legacy, Rare and Unreleased Recordings, 1962 to 2002, from an American blues master. I'm Jim Bickle, Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Phil Picardi. That's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule for a Friday. Back with another roundup on the Monday podcast.
My baby loved me long. Yes, yes, she loved me right. She don't want me to stand outside the house. Screaming and crying all night, she says, "Wee, I believe I've changed my mind." She said, "I'm so glad I'm living, daddy. I cry, my mom, so glad you mind." She said, "I'm so glad I'm living, daddy. I cry, my mom, so glad you mind."
Thank you.